Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we continue to look at, in the third show, more about Wilhelm Reich's work with Orgone and his research into UFOs. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one from Catherine Albrecht's group, Caspian. Experts join with Caspian to oppose RFID tracking in schools. Tracking technology is a dehumanizing threat to privacy and civil liberties. This is Nashua, New Hampshire. A coalition of privacy and civil liberties organizations has issued a position paper on the use of RFID in schools. In it, they call for a moratorium on the use of the controversial chip-based tracking technology. This comes just as San Antonio's North Side Independent School District is preparing to trial RFID at two campuses this month. Jay High School and Jones Middle School say they plan to require students to participate in the new tracking system in order to boost revenues lost due to absences. As many listeners know, RFID uses tiny microchips to track items from a distance. These RFID microchips have earned the name spy chips because each contains a unique ID number, like a social security number for things. These identification and tracking numbers can be read silently and visibly by radio waves right through the walls, clothing, purses, backpacks, and wallets. San Antonio's Northside Independent School District plans to incorporate RFID tags into mandatory student ID cards. One school district in Brazil has incorporated the tracking tags into uniforms. In both cases, the goal is to keep students, teachers, and staff under constant surveillance. Again, this was issued by Dr. Catherine Albrecht. She is the Director of Consumers Against Supermarket Privacy Invasion and Numbering. And she's the co-author of the book, The Spy Chips. In the third of the series about Wilhelm Reich and his work with Orgone Energy, we follow Reich's research into UFOs. In the past two shows, guests Kevin Hinchey and Dr. James DeMeo have outlined the basics of Orgone Energy and also devices to utilize it. Kevin Hinchey defined Orgone Energy as the biological energy in living substances. It's a sexual energy as well as other properties in the human organism, and it's also in atmospheric energy. Dr. DeMeo's work with building cloudbusters and relieving droughts demonstrates the powerful dynamic of Orgone in the atmosphere. Reich's interest and interaction with clouds and UFOs increased as he continued with the drought relief work. In the early 1950s, Wilhelm Reich began noticing, when he pointed the cloudbuster at certain stars, they would blink out or appear unable to sustain themselves in the sky. What was Reich seeing? And what did he notice about the relationship among UFOs and clouds? Our guest, author and researcher Peter Robbins, is one of very few people who has written about this area of Reich's work. Robbins is also a co-author, along with Larry Warren, of the British bestseller Left at Eastgate, a first-hand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. Peter Robbins is an investigative writer, author, and activist, best known for his UFO-related papers, columns, articles, editorials, commentaries, and conference lectures. He's lectured about Dr. Wilhelm Reich and his work in Oregon, France, Greece, New York City, and Princeton. He joins us today to talk more about this particular area of Reich's work. Peter Robbins, welcome to Another News.
Thanks, Jeff. Good to be here.
You know, I wonder if you can just talk basically about what was Reich's interest with UFOs?
Well, none at first. And when I say at first, I mean beginning the summer of 1947, when the phenomena burst upon the American and then the world scene in earnest. It became quite the cause celeb, was covered in all the papers, almost always with mocking condescension, but he had his work and really paid little attention to it until about 1953, when in early experiments with his weather modification apparatus, commonly known as a cloudbuster, he observed UFOs over his property in Rangeley, which is in southern Maine and now is the Wilhelm Reich Museum. And more controversially, the use of the cloudbuster seemed to attract the activity of UFOs. And that autumn, and he writes about it eloquently, and these things were multiply witnessed, well documented, scientifically recorded. He aimed the Cloudbuster at a UFO, an aerial phenomena unknown, and it moved. And he did it again. It faded. They wobbled. Some of them disappeared. This is all recorded very scrupulously in his final book, and I think there are over 20 books all out of print right now by Reich. The book is called Contact with Space and was published a month after his death in December of 1957, unfortunately only written in an edition of 500 copies, but a precious book for those of us who research and investigate such things. And that, to put it mildly, began his interest in the subject.
It's interesting because if it wasn't enough controversy for him with the Orgone energy and the utilizing of that energy, but beginning to observe UFOs and write about them, yes, put him in deeper to more criticism, but also lets you know a little bit about his character. If he's interested in something, it doesn't matter what anyone says. This is something to observe and apply maybe scientific research to.
Well said, Jeff. Reich's entire professional life revolved around a primary interest in how energy functions. And it is the thread that unites all of his work, studies, and discoveries in seemingly such different fields as human psychology and behavior, the origins of fascism and totalitarianism, meteorology, cancer formation, raising healthy children, and on down a litany of extraordinarily important subjects. I think it was a combination of courage, idealism, and to a degree, naivete that caused him to be so upfront about his observations and conclusions and deductions about UFOs, which really propelled a lot of naysayers, people who never looked into his discoveries but only looked to the surface of his interest in human sexuality, thought of him as some kind of quack or mystic or totally loopy individual, none of which were true, to have the courage to publish those findings, which again were used to drive quite a number of extra nails into the coffin of his scientific reputation, very undeserved and historically something I hope that will be corrected in the future.
Now, we're jumping around a little bit here,
yes,
but there's so much to cover.
Yes.
But in one of your papers, Wilhelm Reich and UFOs, the part two, examining the evidence and allegations, you write about Wilhelm Reich, UFOs, and clouds in one part of this.
Yes.
And can you tell listeners a little bit about that significance of Wilhelm Reich's work, Clouds and UFOs?
I'll try. First, the Cloudbuster is a deceptively simple device. The ones I'm familiar with are either trailer-mounted or they're good scale. It's a series of long pipes that are connected to empty industrial BX cable in fairly substantial lengths. The ends of the cables are dumped into a moving river or other body of water. The water, the energy in the water, literally draws energy in the atmosphere down toward the pipes. When he first conducted his initial experiments in rural Maine, the pipes were aimed to the east, drawing from the Atlantic. And it was at a time when there was a fairly serious drought. He broke all weather records in that part of Maine. You could literally put a compass point into Rangeley and spin it around and see the much higher temperature humidity index for that period. What he found was that, employed in a very specific way, the Cloudbuster could either create or negate cloud formations. And I know how that sounds, but I am here to tell you that I've witnessed cloud busting demonstration many years ago, one of the most memorable days of my entire life. I saw clouds cut in half, vaporized, moved from one point in the sky to another over a period of time. He also observed that UFOs And there's been little, if any, follow-up work except by the late Jerome Eden, an adherent to Reich's work, who passed away years ago in Idaho, where he lived and worked, where Eden deduced, and following Reich's observations, that something about UFOs, or at least some truly anomalous UFOs, was that they tended to degenerate or destroy humidity in the atmosphere, and in a sense brought their own tiny little droughts with them. Maybe a good way to think about it is a conventional vehicle, you know, gasoline vehicle, puts out a really nasty toxin which harms the atmosphere. You know, this is common knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that UFOs also seem to be able to generate their own cloud cover. And there are some documented instances of this in more traditional UFO-related literature. The best example I passed along in that paper, which was one that stuck in my mind from United Nations hearings in 1978 on the premise of setting up a permanent UFO study committee, which was quashed in no uncertain terms, is, in my field, a famous series of photos of a UFO taken by a gentleman in Jutland, Denmark, as I recall, about 1976, with his SLR camera, of a disc-shaped object generating a cloud. And the first photo, it looks something like a jellyfish. In the second one, it's hardly apparent. In the third one, it's just a cloud. So it seems to be part of their technical abilities, and again, reflected in the Cloudbuster's ability to affect the energy and the atmosphere.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Was Reich removing orgone energy from the UFOs when he pointed the Cloudbuster at them?
Well, that's purely theoretical, but, you know, common sense, if you really study this literature and develop a genuine appreciation for the seriousness and the actuality of his work, yeah, that's not out of the question at all. He certainly tended to destabilize them, and Dr. Ellsworth F. Baker, a brilliant psychiatrist who followed Reich and became his assistant for the last 12 years of his life, who I had the privilege of knowing quite well for the last years of his life, witnessed this, as well as several trained Cloudbusters, one of whom I spoke to, another of whose widow I corresponded with. And these things were multiply witnessed and well documented, and people's reputations attached to those observations.
In Arizona, you wrote about Reich observing Air Force planes flying over their site. I guess they were being monitored as well, but also they would see UFOs show up with cloud cover. Now, he suspected that this cloud cover was for UFOs specifically sometimes.
That it had been manufactured or produced by them to obfuse their presence, yes. And again, I know how our conversation here may sound to many of your listeners, and although I don't live in New York City now, it is my home. I love it more than any place in the world. I am a longtime listener to BAI. I cut my teeth on it in the 70s, and I'm delighted to be on the network right now. But the fact is that these are facts. And his experimental work outside of Tucson on a leased 10-acre site in 1954, not only ended up breaking every single weather record in the history of Arizona, it caused it to snow at the Tucson airport around Christmas of 1954. It created, unfortunately, on a certain level, floods, managed floods, but in an area which had not seen more than a few inches of rain in the previous half century. These things are part of, you know, the meteorological history of the state of Arizona. And yes, it culminated in what he characterized, and you read the literature and the witness accounts, as something of a battle between Cloudbusters, which were trying to increase the humidity from the atmosphere, and were doing a brilliant job of it, drawing from the west and the Pacific. And you can plot rain over several weeks from Los Angeles on, right to the area outside of Tucson in the weeks leading right up to it on a gunsight straight line. It's a phenomenal specialty area of study.
What do you think Wilhelm Reich was really interested in with the UFO activity? Do you suspect he was also interested in their propulsion mechanisms?
Oh, sure. How could a brilliant mind not be? And this from a man who had interfaced and had an extraordinary, intense relationship with Einstein at a time when Einstein had begun highly classified work on what we now know to be the Manhattan Project and was compelled, for reasons we can make educated guesses about, of denying Reich's work, which he had earlier accepted and found absolutely historic, and then cutting off all correspondence with him. The Reich-Einstein letters run for many dozens of pages and are available from scholarly sources, including the Rangeley bookstore there. But yes, I think that his natural interest in the world around him would have, and did, compel him, and he writes about it again in Contact with Space in No Uncertain Terms, of what were they here for? What was the propulsive source? What was their intention? Or was the byproduct, the exhaust, so to say, from their propulsive sources, was it intentional? Was it, you know, not intentional, like our conventional vehicles here on Earth, but still doing damage to the atmosphere? Now, there are a number of areas and reasons why he was extremely interested in the subject.
We didn't really talk about the exhaust in your paper under the section UFO activity in clouds. On different occasions, Reich observed what he felt was a direct relationship between UFO activity in clouds. He postulated that if UFOs were orgone-fueled machines, that dead orgone energy would
commonly
be
referred to as DOR, yeah.
D-O-R, yeah, would be their exhaust.
Yep.
If such a relationship existed, it would have a functional basis. That's a really good analysis or observation. I think I would have missed if it was intentional or not.
Well, yeah, I like to think that it is unintentional where it occurs, and what he was able to document absolutely in the most scrupulous scientific terms, and this is not contestable, was where the UFO activity, when it would occur, the humidity in the atmosphere would drop noticeably. And it happened enough times over the several-month period that he and his associates were working out of their area outside of Tucson, that you look at these calibrations, and at whatever point the human mind sort of gives up, you realize there is no chance of coincidence that when the UFOs would appear in that area, their instrumentation would measure noticeable, sometimes dramatic, drops in the humidity, which they had been working for weeks to build and build. In fact, for me, one of the most poignant moments in this extraordinary episode in scientific advancement is that before it actually rained, there was so much humidity in the air that in the several acres surrounding the cloudbusters, they had brought two of them out on trailers from the East Coast, prairie grass had spontaneously begun to grow around the apparatuses and in the surrounding couple of acres in the desert, right out of the sand, dormant seeds that, you know, were there for who knows how long. Mm-hmm. This was a week or so before it actually began to rain.
Living energy.
Yeah, and a lot of moisture where there had been very little.
In Trevor James Constable's book, Sky Creatures, mm-hmm. he writes about some of these UFOs retaliating. I'm not sure what he saw and if it's conjecture. However, he did write about somebody leaning up against a cloudbuster and a silver disc had come into view and possibly sent a pulse through the cloudbuster and paralyzed half of his body.
Mm. I think he may be referring to Robert McCullough, who was a trained cloudbuster operator and whose widow I was recently indirectly in contact with through a mutual friend for her memories of that period of time. Creepy as that sounds, that may be the case. However, the Cloudbusters themselves put out their own immediate area of toxicity when they are working. And I will tell you, from my experience, one thing that we were told before observing this demonstration in a rural area of New Jersey years ago, under the sponsorship of the American College of Agronomy, was not to come close to the trailer-mounted apparatus when it was working. And when the experiment was over, myself and the group that I was with were quite so overwhelmed by what we had seen that a number of us kind of spontaneously moved toward the machine. I saw one of my colleagues spontaneously throw up lunch, and I had the experience, the only time in my life before or after, as I got close, of feeling that somebody had, like, aimed the equivalent of a hairdryer up my nostrils. I literally felt my sinus cavities dry out like that. And it was a very sobering experience. So Constable, while I respect his work on a certain level and have not looked into trying to document some of what he cites in it or follow up on some of his research, there was a certain bombastic macho quality to his work and a character sense for me of somebody who really liked the idea and the romance of dominating the atmosphere and natural forces, which is not necessarily a good credential for somebody to have who is taking the responsibility for affecting the weather around them. So I think he may have deduced something informed by a more or less romantic sense that may not have been so, but there's no question. It's not out of the question, but I do know from my own experience and observations that these devices, being very close to them when they're operating, can make you feel ill.
A couple things here. One is I brought this up because that's where I first heard about the interaction between UFOs and Reich's work. I bring it up also because while you're working to relieve the drought in certain areas, you mentioned that the UFOs will bring a dry air when they are in the area. So it's almost like working against you. And I wondered if at any point you viewed the UFO activity as going against the work.
Well, when you say you, I know you're speaking euphemistically because I am not a cloudbuster operator.
Right.
I have only observed and have made it my business to learn all I can about it. Your previous guest, Dr. James DeMeo, for my money, is the world's ranking individual who has been involved in discreetly helping to break droughts
right.
in various countries around the world, and he is the man who could speak about this maybe more firsthand, obviously, than I could. But my thought here, and it is only informed by my many years in the study of UFOs and as a writer and investigative author on it, that if UFOs do give off a toxicity as a byproduct of their operating systems, maybe even with their advanced grasp of technology, it is difficult or impractical to add, the equivalent of some kind of carburetor filter or something that it might inhibit their power to function as they do. Again, this is all theoretical, mm-hmm. and it's arrogant to say we know the unknowable here. After more than 35 years of studying this subject, I know how little I know. But I do know certain things, and I could probably make better educated guesses than most people. I prefer to think that this is not intentional. If it is, then we have a little bit more to be concerned about relative to these other intelligences and their advanced technology.
Peter Robbins, thanks for describing that, because I didn't mean to put you on the spot. But
no, perfectly okay.
Okay. So the other thing that I thought about when you were describing the Cloudbuster effect around it is possibly a feedback loop generating as the Cloudbuster is in use. Did it slowly gather more energy around it over time?
You know, I'm not sure. I do know that properly employed, they do increase the humidity in the air. There's no question about it. And they can and have been successfully used to help break droughts around the world. Unfortunately, because of the ridicule factor that is still so ferociously attached to Reich's work out of ignorance, because proper official scientists know, in quotes, that the work was not of value, or they'd know it. Very few, if any, have bothered to replicate even his simplest experiments, which some of which even lay people like you or I can do and have done. It is dismissed wholesale. And again, that red thread goes back to his years working as Freud's assistant. And over time, in working in the Freudian method, coming to a point of disagreement with Freud where they split in 1929, Freud's point of view being that many human neuroses are rooted in sexual dysfunction and pathology. Reich's observation was that no matter how obscured in other seeming aspects of a person's life, that really all human neuroses were rooted in one way or another in a lack of energetic equilibrium from having a healthy, regular functioning sex life. And so given our moralistic and paternalistic society and our tendency to either mechanize or mysticize what we truly don't understand, his work is still ignored and overwhelmingly, except for small groups. And I would like to think at some point in the future, most likely when we're not here, it will be studied and recognized for the extraordinary life-affirmative aspects that it offers humanity.
If listeners want to get more involved with groups that study Reich and meet regularly to discuss Reich's work, how do they do that?
Well, there are many so-called Reichian therapists and practitioners around this country and in other countries. And in order to be one, I think the qualification is you touch your finger to your nose and you turn around three times. Anybody can call themselves a Reichian therapist. Medical orgonomists, as trained by Reich and then by Baker, number in maybe a few dozen worldwide. And as far as groups that are responsible, well-read, respectful of the material, there are more of them in Europe than there are here. My first inclination would be to contact the Orgone Biophysical Research Laboratory, or OBRL, also known as Green Springs, which exists just outside of Ashland, Oregon, and is run by Dr. DeMeo, a place I've had the pleasure and privilege of visiting and spending time on a number of occasions over the years, either for conferences or otherwise. And that Jim would probably be the person to have the most information on that.
Great. Peter, can you tell listeners just a little bit about your background? I briefly mentioned it in the introduction, but can you tell listeners how you got involved researching Reich's work and UFOs?
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to. When I was a university student, 19-year-old, my roommate, a dear friend then and a dear friend now, came back from a holiday vacation very excited about two books that he was reading and suggested that I read both. One was Das Kapital by Karl Marx, which I had a real problem with. But hey, you know, it was the 60s and we were kids. The other was Character Analysis by Dr. Wilhelm Reich, which I understand is probably the only book that official psychology recognizes as worthwhile before he went crazy, which is everybody has a different way of dealing with their anxieties about his work by attacking his sanity. I recognize something in the book of tremendous importance, and also a great deal of it I recognized as beyond me. But over the intervening years, I began to buy and read other books by him. And it wasn't until the later 1970s that I learned that Dr. Baker was still alive and well and practicing, and I made it my business to meet him. But also about that time, I recalled a childhood UFO sighting, which, having had what I can only describe as a very happy, kind of boring, you know, sort of leave it to beaver post-war kind of childhood, may well have been my only or certainly my major repressed memory of childhood. And it was of a profound daylight sighting over the home that I grew up in a village about 30 miles east of Manhattan on Long Island. and I had shared that sighting with my sister. And to compress, I did call her. She confirmed the incident. I became obsessed with the subject. And up until that point, I was one of those kids who knew what I wanted to do from the time I was 5 or 6 years old. I was quite precocious as a visual artist, had oil painting lessons when I was 8 years old and went on to study at and then go on the faculty of New York's outstanding School of Visual Arts, something I'll always be very proud of. And by that point in my 20s, I was working away on my life career as a painter and working during the day helping to renovate buildings in New York Soho, at that time in its infancy as a art neighborhood and going through a building boom, and considered myself a blue-collar intellectual and loved the life that I was living, but this changed everything. And I'll tell you what, Jeff, I resented it tremendously. All I had ever wanted to do was be a painter, photographer, sculptor, and now there was something more compelling and more important. And that's more than 30 years ago. And I can't say I've never looked back, but it's what I continue to do, and that's how I became in the field of ufology and what I still do primarily.
Well, Peter, thank you for sharing that background. It's really important that listeners understand a little bit more about you and how amazingly connected you are with the topic and this area. So that it's really fascinating. Well, we're at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to open up the phone lines. If you have a comment or question for Peter Robbins, call us at 212-209-2900, and we'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Our guest, Peter Robbins. We're talking about Cloudbusters, Reich's work, Wilhelm Reich, and his focus into UFOs. I noticed something, Peter, that the energy that you were talking about coming from the water into the BX cable of the Cloudbuster reminded me of the Great Pyramid and, of course, the Wardenclyffe Tower that Tesla built. They both, the structures had descending passageways into subterranean caverns of water.
Yeah.
So is there a connection there?
Knowing a certain amount, but certainly not being any kind of authority on either of these extraordinary structures, in my gut sense is that there is this common functioning principle at work of attraction, the same way in the simplest sense as I mentioned to you when we chatted a few days ago that my Russian grandmother had this folk remedy of cutting a potato in half if you had a pimple or a boil and you'd hold it to your face. And as a kid, you just knew it felt cool. But in reality, it was drawing the toxin to the surface, creating a quicker time for the thing to come to crisis and then heal. And it is this drawing of energy to energy. Some would think that it just can't be that simple, and yet it is.
We're going to go to the first call. Hi, you're on the air with Peter Robbins.
Yeah, how you doing, Jeff?
Good.
Yeah, how you doing, Mr. Robbins?
Good.
I just heard about Dr. William Reich on in other news, and I've got a few of his some of his literature.
Yeah.
And I ordered some books on the website. Some of his work is, I'm a technical person. I've been involved in science and working in a technical field.
Oh, good.
Some of his work is hard to get my mind around, though.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
And I was introduced to his work, as I mentioned, as a teenager. And I'm not a teenager anymore.
Yeah.
And the reality is, this is the way it is. And we're used to thinking in terms of mechanistic generation of energy or electrical energy or you know, the whole pantheon of energies that most folks think in terms of, especially somebody who's technically minded or a scientist or an engineer. But this is as real. It is simply as natural as things get. But we've been kind of shown shiny objects all our life, and look at a piston engine motor or a jet engine or nuclear fuel or solar power or what have you, and the attention has been taken away from Reich's extraordinary contributions to humanity. And as I mentioned, I hope someday we as a species can turn our attention back to it. At this point, it's a small community of people, but with folks like you hopefully taking the time to educate yourself to it, it is growing.
Well, it's fascinating work, and I mean, I can understand some of it based on the principles of the law of conservation of energy. Energy is never destroyed, just changes form.
That's right.
And how I think what I'm getting about his work is how he can capture that form in the etheric and convert it and use it. It's just one question I wanted to ask was, outside of the small circle, Baker and the others, has anyone recently ever taken the blueprints for a cloud buster and actually used it, like in the past 10 or 15 years?
Well, yes. Dr. James DeMeo, who I mentioned and who was a guest, of course, recently on the program, is one of the world's ranking scholars and probably the most experienced cloudbuster operator in the world, has built and used a number of them very successfully to help break droughts around this country and in other countries as well. And I would direct you to his laboratory website, because it's just an absolute treasure chest of information on orgonomy, and he publishes so many of the results he's had over the years, many scholarly papers as well. It's also a clearinghouse for other sources of information.
What's the website?
If you Google OBRL.
OBRL.
Yeah, for Orgone Biophysical Research Laboratory, in a click or two, it will take you to his website. And I think you'll find a lot of stuff that will interest you there, as well as a terrific offering of written information on it. There's so much specious, nonsensical, vicious information on Reich out there. Jim is one of the few sources that I would recommend anybody to. And if he has a book or a publication in stock, you can pretty much be guaranteed that it's scientific, respectable, respectful, or at least informed by Reich's work in a very real and reasonable way.
Well, it's about the open mind. I mean, you can't close your mind if you call yourself a true scientist.
No, you're absolutely right. And unfortunately, many scientists do. You remind me of a wonderful quote by a physicist named Max Planck, which is, science progresses funeral by funeral.
Well, that's a fantastic quote. I really appreciate that, Ed, for those great questions. And we're going to go to the next call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Mike. Just great show. I love your show. I haven't been listening that long, but I just love your show. Quick question. With the way energy patterns have changed from prior ancient times, I mean, from them relocating pyramids, from the archaeological digs, to modern time, with now we have microwave and everything, the microwave towers, how does that affect the flow of the planet and people in general, animals, life in general?
Boy, that's a great question. I am not sure. But overall, in terms of microwaves and other kinds of intrusive energy forms, I'm going to make an educated guess that it has not been a positive force on life.
It's not conducive to the planet, definitely.
No.
Definitely. Just, and to follow up on that, with I don't want to call it negative energy, but with the outtaking of what originally was here, would you say that would affect our solar system as a whole?
I would guess not, in that our solar system is so immense compared to our wonderful little planet here. But it probably has not had a great effect on our immediate atmosphere. I would speculate on that for sure.
And thank you for your work. Thank you so much for your work.
And thank you for your kind comment.
Thank you.
You bet.
Great question, Peter. That's one I think about a lot. Past guest, we had Peter Champeau, who talked about the ley lines and geometry of the planet. And also Dr. Carmen Bolter, who talked about the natural telluric energy in the atmosphere, the magnetics of the atmosphere.
Yes.
We've been removed from that and a lot from the aerosol operations and things like that and altering of the atmosphere. And one last thing, Ross Hamilton, who recently came out with that book, Star Mounds, Legacy of Native American Mystery, said that the atmosphere is much different now than it was 3,000 to 4,000 years ago.
Oh, I can only imagine. It would have to be. If you think back to even the dawn of the 19th century and the advent of the building of you know, factories and railways in England and then here and then around Europe and around the world, it amazes me right now that there are so many Americans who are so ideologically refusing to look at climate change and the tremendous contribution to the damage, no matter how much of it might be natural, in part, with all due respect to people of faith, because it's very difficult, I think, for some folks to acknowledge that we, mere human beings, could have done the kind of damage that many of us feel we have done to such an immense space. But we have, and it's continuing.
Indeed. We're going to go to the next call. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, my name is Yara. I enjoy your show very much. I have a very simple question.
Yeah.
Would Oregon energy be the equivalent to chi energy, as in the martial arts?
It's so interesting you mentioned that, Yura. Actually, allegorically, symbolically, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that, for me, marks Reich's genius as a scientist very rooted in the Western tradition, who was very anti-mystical in his thinking and felt, you know, religion truly was the opiate of the people, there are so many parallels to what he was able to calibrate, measure, and document in the laboratory about the way that energy moves, and in this sense, through the human organism, that simply confirms or overlays much more esoteric traditions of energy studies. So, yes, the answer to that question, I feel, is yes.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Yep.
Thank you for that call. Okay, you're on the air with Peter Robbins.
Yeah, I happened to hear your show just after the beginning. I noticed cloud formations. If you're in an airplane or sometimes on the ground, you can see different images that look like characters and human in the clouds, and then they dissipate. And then sometimes at sunset, you can see that the clouds are like chasing each other to go into the next day instead of being, you know, the clouds stuck in the nighttime. Mm. Is that an observation, or is that just my observation?
I think it's a great question. As somebody who is self-trained in terms of scientific method, but who grew up kind of living and working outside of the box in the arts, what I observe in nature is that there's constant replication or indications of shapes and forms that we identify with, you know, our three-dimensional world. Some years ago, some of your listeners may be aware that there's a very famous formation in New Hampshire called the Old Man in the Mountain. I remember visiting it as a child, and it simply, as happens quite a lot, you saw what seemed to be the profile of, you know, an old man as part of the mountain cliff. It collapsed some years back. But the same way that, yes, you can see a shape that might look like a lamb or, you know, a human face or a butterfly in a cloud, and then it dissipates and transforms into something else. I think that's all very subjective and doesn't have to do with the kind of energy that we're talking about, but in a way is one of the joys and mysteries of nature, that it keeps offering us these shifting forms that, you know, we play with in our minds and often associate with things at random.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, caller, for that question. And it, I recently learned this term, pareidolia, the ability of the mind to create you know, faces and shapes from, you know, such as like paneling on the wall or clouds and things like that.
Yeah.
For some reason, I have some old paneling in
a room in my apartment, and the faces are just really horrific looking. I look over, I'm like, is that really there? You know, and you know, of course, they repeat because they have the pattern in them. They don't. Nothing new comes up. It's just a repetition of those faces. Anyway, you know, it's another story.
Dip into a bag of chips, and you know, there is a human face on a potato chip staring at you until you eat it.
Right. And that last caller, though, I was thinking to myself, the question may have been sparked by the relationship with UFOs and clouds and how UFOs could be manipulating clouds or have clouds around them and moving around the atmosphere.
Or generating them, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it was a very sweet question in its unique way, and I think it's one of the things that just makes life more playful, that you do see these things and then they're gone.
Indeed. I think we have another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Good evening. Yes, Peter, this is Brandon. Hey, Jeff, how are you?
Hey, great.
Hi, Brandon.
Hey, I've been doing a lot of work in this area, not knowing that it was Orgo and studying it with also Ross, Hamilton, and others. And, you know, we were out at the Serpent Mound, and we see a spiral, the tail, traditionally is an energy vortex. The ball or little sphere out in front of the snake's mouth might be a point mass. And I submit to you possibly, Peter, a model for appreciating things sort of like in the Fermi model approach maybe you could comment on. Simply this, you take Einstein's equation, E is equal to mc squared, divide both sides by c, the speed of light, so we haven't changed it. What you have is E divided by c is equal to m times c. Looking at the Serpent Mound tail is possibly the energy being drawn, and this mound, it's supposedly a drawer of light. The ball is the orb out in front of the Serpent Mound snake mouth. And so what we have possibly, Peter, and I'll wrap this up quickly, is sort of like the Native American solution to understand that it's really momentum, mass times velocity, m times c, constantly sort of like a string theory momentum. That's the energy. Possibly we, the mind, is in between the equal sign, and so we're always oscillating this energy to matter dance that we have with our creative energy, our mind being sort of the equals transition from energy to matter, and then the matter in which we interact here manifesting, you know, sort of like in the universe that we play with. So I was wondering if these sorts of ideas, sort of like a Fermi model, sort of referring it back again to native concepts and to Einstein, sort of like unifies a simple way of getting a handle on difficult matters.
Well, what I got from what you said, because your technical knowledge is much beyond mine, makes sense to me, but more to the point, Reich referred in later energetic studies regularly to spiral galaxies and what he called spinning waves of energy formation as a basic concept that informed his work. And it's just fascinating that you would point that out. Again, like the earlier question, relative to similarities in you know, more esoteric energy studies, be it chakras or that kind of spinning form in a native mound, yes, I think that these are absolute parallels that were recognized by our predecessors. But the thing, one of the marks of Reich's genius for me that is not recognized, so to say, by official science, is that he was the first, I think, the first Western scientist to fully sketch out, not even intending to, but the parallels between all of these ancient traditions, which were absolutely authentic, and being able to measure this kind of energy and document it in laboratory.
And also tangibly feel it. He must have had such an intuition to read the fractals, to be immersed in that soup, and in the in-between of matter-energy to be able to appreciate this. Most difficult thing is the transmutation. What is happening at that instant where matter is no longer energy and energy no longer matter?
You know, that's a subject for about 10 shows in a row.
But it's great.
Before I let you go, I will tell you that you might want to contact the Wilhelm Reich Museum in Rangeley, Maine, and contact their bookstore. They have there an extraordinarily interesting scholarly collection of the correspondence between Reich and Einstein, and it is fascinating and very troubling.
It's all part of the lathe of heaven. I don't mean to cut in here, but to your next caller, and Jeff, thanks so much. And as you know, I love the books, Jeff, so it's a dangerous suggestion that Peter gives me. Take care.
Thank you, Brendan. Mm-hmm. Really appreciate that call. Hi, you're on the air.
Just a question. Has anyone started researching or looking into orgone energy as far as a source of free energy to, like, heat our houses or run our cars or something like that?
Well, I know there was some work on that in the late 40s. Even one of Reich's most controversial discoveries, because it was the actual prototype, was stolen from the laboratory in 1948. It was an orgone energy motor. And I spoke to a number of people, and this goes back to the later 70s and into the 80s, who saw it. All gone now, unfortunately.
No one else can reproduce this?
Well, one of the things, Reich concerned that the schematics for it would be somehow co-opted, did not include one or two important notations, which, of course, naysayers will say, oh, well, of course, and, you know, there never was such a thing. But there was, and it is now a footnote to orgonomy, or the study of how energy functions. I don't know if anyone is working on this contemporaneously. That is another thing that you might want to a question to pose to Dr. DeMeo, who, again, for me, is centrally connected in this work right now, and has a terrific website with an awful lot of information available.
Okay. Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Caller, thank you for bringing that up. It's something that I asked Dr. DeMeo. That interview has been posted on NewYorkSkywatch.com as well, and the previous one with Kevin Hinchey is also on there. You can't even come close to covering Dr. Reich's work in 3 hours, but you can come close to maybe piquing the interest of listeners to dig in a little bit deeper and get those books and start your library and conversation, discussion with other people who are interested in it. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the people that are really interested in this are really cool people.
Yeah.
We got another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Go ahead, caller.
Yes, I want to congratulate you on the high caliber of the show and the callers.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to let you know that when I interviewed the great cryptozoologist Ivan Sanderson's widow, she told me that he was in agreement with John Keel, the writer, that UFOs were a phenomenon of very powerful and intelligent spiritual beings. And that's what I have to say.
Thank you. I'm a big fan of Ivan Sanderson's writing, and I hope that at least some of them are that.
Okay. That's very interesting. Can I give you an anecdote?
Sure. Go ahead, caller.
Okay, quickly. The only time in all my travels to New York City, and I live in New Jersey, that I was ever threatened by muggers was two incidences, and they were coincidentally at the same time at NYU. I began lectures by the Reichian therapist who practiced that in New York City.
Who was the therapist, may I ask?
I can't remember. This is 30-plus years ago.
Yeah.
But I thought it very not coincidental that they, quote, someone who was sensitive and looking into that dissuade them, and then I actually stopped going to the lectures after two of them because I was frankly in fear that, you know, what was going on. I wasn't sure, but...
Well, I don't know if they're related. I'm sorry that happened, and I'm sorry you didn't get to finish the lectures. I studied scientific and social ergonomy at NYU back in the day when it was taught, and found it extremely valuable and interesting.
Well, I wished other things had me there, but you fellas are doing great work, and thanks for these shows.
Thank you, caller. Really appreciate that story, too. We got another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, great show. I love your topic. I always do a great show. Really quick, because I know time is fleeting.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, was Reich ever threatened, or was he ever tried to be suppressed? And the other thing is, was this the age before the chemtrails, which is some of your favorite subjects? Did Reich die under mysterious circumstances? Was his work stolen?
Very good questions. All, yes, it was well before the chemtrails. Oh, yes, he was threatened. And not only that, the FDA mounted an entirely, sadly, bogus case against him that was won on a technicality. In 1955, he was sentenced to prison and was found dead in his cell in November 1957, a little more than a week before his scheduled release. I would not jump to the conclusion that he was murdered because he had high blood pressure, he chain smoked, he was a type A character, probably broke his heart to be in prison. But from the earlier, from about 54, 55, I may be off by a year, until a few months before Kennedy was inaugurated, more than 6 tons of his original literature, first edition books, monographs, were burned in government incinerators, making him a member of a very, very small club in this country, much to the shame of the United States of America.
Right. Well, the last thing is, you know, this whole thing with UFOs, I mean, is there malevolent beings that are controlling our government and don't want the evolution of man to reach its full potential?
You have 15 seconds for that, Peter.
Yeah, I think so. you know, just look at some of the people who have governed our country. I'm not saying Dick Cheney is behind it all, but I think that there are some people in government who are much more interested in being secret keepers than elevating the level of discourse or of the condition of humanity. That's just an educated guess.
Right, but are there aliens that are actually in control of the government?
Oh, God, I don't know.
Yeah,
we're getting close, I think. I think some people are really getting close to that. Caller, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you.
I really
thank
appreciate
it. Great show. I love your show.
Have a great evening. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Our guest, Peter Robbins. How can listeners get in touch with you, Peter?
Right now, I've got a Facebook. I've got a website in construction. You can contact me through Facebook. Google my work, find it on YouTube, or look into hearing me at conferences or other radio shows around the United States.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us this evening.
I was glad to, Jeff. I hope. Thank you for the invitation.
Excellent. Okay. Can I have you back on soon?
Great.
Have a great evening.
You too.
See you in a couple of weeks. We're preempted next week, so the following Monday, 10 p.m.